Welcome, everybody, to the podcast that's dedicated to making you a faster cyclist, the Ask a Cycling Coach podcast presented by Trainer Road. This is the podcast where you can get answers to your coaching questions from certified coaches. My name is Jonathan Lee. I'm a certified coach, and I take up the PR duties here at Trainer Road. And joining me today is Coach Chad Timmerman. How you doing, Chad?
I'm doing great, Jonathan. Thanks.
And founder of Trainer Road, Nate Pearson. How you doing, Nate?
Doing good.
Good. Good to hear. As a reminder to all of you that are joining us live or listening after the fact, you can submit your training questions to us at support@trainerroad.com at any point throughout the week, or you can type them into the questions panel that you see right now if you're joining us via GoToWebinar, and we'll handle the questions that way. You can also listen to this podcast after the fact on SoundCloud or on iTunes. You can just look us up in any of the different podcast apps that you have, and you should be able to find us. Just search for Trainer Road or Ask a Cycling Coach. And we encourage you guys to leave a review, as always. Leave a review for us and let us know how much you like the podcast. Hopefully you like us enough to give us 5 stars. We'd love that. So we'll kick it off right now. We've got a lot of questions to go through today, so we'll start with Ian's question. And we're going to kind of have a common theme here where we go through training plan selection questions before we move on to other ones. Ian asks, do you guys have any tips for preparing for a 24-hour mountain bike race in July 2016? Any base, build, and specialty plans that you would recommend?
Yeah, so Ian, a 24-hour event definitely qualifies as ultra endurance, which makes me lean toward traditional base as your base approach. You can decide between the two, but that's the one I would recommend. And then because it is an ultra endurance event, I'd recommend tacking on the additional 2 weeks on the end of each of those before moving on to a sustained power build. And then probably the marathon mountain bike plan would be your best bet. In any case, you've got the requisite 34 weeks that you would need to accommodate the extended base period and then the subsequent 8-week build and specialty phases.
So I have a question. For those who aren't Trainer Road members, what did you just say? What does that mean?
So in terms of base, being out there, and I'm assuming this is an individual event where you're not, you know, relaying for an hour or a lap of the course, but you're riding the entire 24 hours. And correct me if I'm wrong, but if that's the case, then you're going to rely heavily on a strong aerobic base. And the traditional approach to base conditioning is long, slow distance, where you basically teach your body to metabolize fat as its preferred fuel source. And you do that at low intensities and long durations. So, you know, multiple hours in the saddle working at pretty light intensities. And then as you move into your sustained into your build period where you're trying to build slightly more specific fitness, your emphasis is going to shift more toward muscular endurance, which is, you know, at a higher percentage of your functional threshold where you're working at 85, maybe 95% of threshold for, you know, extended durations. And then in your case, because this is a mountain bike event, a mountain bike specialty plan, which addresses the wide-ranging demands of mountain bike riding.
And I assume in this case, Ian, also, if you are going to be doing this, in fact, by yourself, I assume that you will be taking a certain amount of breaks. So all I would encourage as a fellow mountain biker is to make sure that you take into account all the demands that your body's going to go under, and not just riding 24 hours by spinning your pedals, but also being on the trails. It takes a toll on your body, so get a strategy in place. Having said that, you may be a sage with that type of stuff, so my advice may be falling on experienced ears there. Graham, being a responsibly experienced time trialist, my main goals next year will be a 100-mile, 12-hour, and 24-hour between June 16th. I've ridden these events before, so I'm aiming to improve my performance. However, while the above events will be my main 2016 targets, I will also do the odd 10-mile, 25-mile, and 50-mile time trial, plus the occasional distance in between. The shorter distances I definitely do less well in. I have previously commuted through the winter, but this year my focus will be on following one of your training plans. My first competitive TT is in early March 2016. Lastly, I will continue to ride on the road on a Saturday with my friends doing around 70 to 100 miles. I'll shortly purchase the PowerTap P1 power meter pedals and start to record my heart rate both on the kicker and out on the road. Your advice on which training program to follow will be very much appreciated. So we have a time trialist that has a longer one that he's really preparing for, but he's going to be doing other events too, so somewhat typical.
And so, Graham, you're much in the vein of Ian's approach in that you have to build a big aerobic base. You, however, don't have a whole lot of time. So whereas a traditional approach with a long, slow distance builds a firmer base, you need a quicker base, in which case the sweet spot base, the sweet spot base plans where you're working, you know, 85, 90% of your functional threshold for increasing periods of time. So you kind of got to build your base in a hurry, and it may not be as sturdy, but it'll be there when you need it come March. As far as a build plan, you as well are in that sustained batch. So sustained power, in which case you're targeting your muscular endurance, your ability to not only push the pedals hard, but do it for long periods of time. And then as far as a specialty for something like that, probably, I mean, you could do the time trial specialty plan where you know, focus on time trialing since you want to incorporate shorter duration events. But you could just as easily go with the century if you want to shift your focus primarily to those 12 and 24 hour events.
Yeah, how would you choose between that, Chad? Would it just be kind of what your A race would be, and if your A race is kind of the shorter stuff, do time trial, and if
exactly, yeah. So yeah. You have to prioritize. I mean, you're running the spectrum there between extensive endurance and shorter harder stuff. So you're gonna have to decide which is more important to you and prioritize accordingly.
That's something too that I think just in general, a lot of cyclists, you know, we like to do. You know, I'll do road races, I'll do crits, but then time trialing is going to be my A race. So instead of trying to, I mean, you could too. You could easily be a jack of all trades, mm-hmm. but if you really want to focus on one thing, then you kind of, you know, the beginning of the season's the same where you're building your fitness and you're building your threshold, and it gets a little bit different as you're in your build phase. But then you kind of really focus on whatever your top A race is and train. It's all the principle of
specificity.
That's a big word. And training like the kind of riding you're going to do, which is, you know, we build that in the plans. But again, a lot of people listen to this podcast who aren't trainer road members, and it's a rule of thumb to live by. I mean, it makes so much sense, but a lot of people don't follow it.
Yeah, and you have to understand that there's overlap. So it's not like if you follow a criterium training plan, you're only going to be good at criteriums. I mean, there's lots of carryover to similar disciplines. So just understand you prioritize what's most important, and everything else, most times you're going to be pleasantly surprised with the level of fitness you bring to the table.
And we'll actually cover some questions that have to do with the same concept later on of overlap that exists within road races. So we'll keep those ones somewhat short, but that's a principle that we can all do well of taking note of. It's certainly the type of fitness that we're building with these efforts. Don't just think that it's only going to help you if you're on a track, for example, if you're preparing for track racing, or in a triathlon if you're only preparing for tri stuff. Fitness crosses over to a certain extent, as long as the demands are similar. So, and even then, you can stretch it a bit. Ted, you have a somewhat related question. You ask, how can I prepare for rides over 100 miles, like a double metric or a double century, with high-intensity interval training? So how does high-intensity interval training help somebody that's doing a long ride like that, Chad?
You're along the same lines. You know, you have to, a big aerobic base is a concern. When it comes to high-intensity training, it kind of boils down to, you know, how quickly do you want your fitness? You can go about it a couple different ways with long, slow distance, or you can start incorporating bits of higher intensity in order to ratchet up the intensity and the training response more quickly. So I think regardless of the type of training, that high intensity has a place pretty much all the time. It doesn't have to be the focus. In fact, it's not often the focus until you get closer to your events. But there's a lot of benefit to the short, hard stuff. A lot of stuff that people don't recognize actually carries over to their lower end conditioning.
Yeah, and I personally have never been on a large ride where somebody didn't get a little excited and put the sting in your legs, right? So it's the type of stuff that when you're on the bike for hours on end and you're doing those type of efforts, that's really going to help you out too. So, Ted, follow-up question. I focus my training on hills and have done so for 18 months. I'm the right size for hill climbing, but I'm slower than many local athletes. What do I need to work on? Climbing in higher gears, would that help?
Yeah, actually, I've kind of perused the questions today, and we're going to touch on this a little bit later with a question from a local rider. It boils down to two things, strength and then endurance, and then coupling the two. So three things, if you want to be technical. But you have to develop the capability to push the pedals harder. Or if you have the option, using a smaller gear at a slightly quicker cadence. In any case, you don't want to make these highly grinding, mashing, forceful pedal strokes. So if you're not already geared out and you actually have gears to explore, use them. Try climbing at higher cadence rates and see how that works for you. Typically, it unloads the muscles a bit and shifts the stress a little more centrally to your heart and lungs. If you are geared out, though, it's going to be a matter of cultivating strength.
And by strength, you mean FTP, right, Chad? Because that's really the reason why he's climbing the hill slower is because of his power to weight ratio.
That's the endurance component.
Not his squats.
Of it. Yeah. So yeah, when I talk about strength, I'm talking about how hard you can push the pedals. You can build that in a number of ways, and then you have to transition that or transfer that strength gain into longer events or longer durations. You have to build strength endurance. So got to be able to push pedals hard. Got to be able to do it for a long time. But there's a number of ways to go about it. We push most riders toward this sweet spot approach where you're working at a pretty high percentage of threshold, but not one that beats you up too severely.
So the idea too, that just to reiterate this, Ted, the reason why you're as long as you have appropriate gearing, the reason why you're falling behind in the climbs, it's your power to weight ratio. So your FTP, and when Chad says sweet spot base of working around 85 to 95% of FTP, that will help increase your the power that you can sustain for a long time. Now, if it's really really short hills, like a minute or 2 minute. That's going to be also related to your FTP, but also have a lot to do with VO2 max and doing intervals like that. But I'm assuming in this case that these are longer climbs where your FTP is going to be your power to weight ratio is going to be the determining factor.
One side note on this as well for climbers or cyclists that are trying to become better climbers, pick a position and stick with it. And in most cases, a seated position is always going to be king. It's going to allow you to be able to put out more power more efficiently in most cases, but train in that position. Make sure that you aren't completely unfamiliar with standing out of the saddle. Make sure that you're experienced with that too, but dedicate and focus your training to be done in certain positions. If you're the type of person that's constantly in and out of the saddle, that's generally what we do when times are tough. So if you can train yourself beforehand to ride and to put out that high level of power and force over an extended period of time in a consistent position, that's really going to pay off for you too. So,
yeah. Another thing about this is that, if you're a smaller rider and you're riding in a group, and I can keep up in the group, that's because you're drafting. So you're, the people in the front are putting out more energy to cut through the dense, thick air. But then as you get to a hill and you get dropped, the air resistance is a lower component, in the equation of what causes a cyclist to go slower, it gets reduced because you're not going as fast. The big component is gravity. So again, it goes back to power to weight. So a lot of people say, I can keep up, but then the hills, so I'm just a bad climber. No, it's not just you're a bad climber. You have a lower power to weight ratio than other people. That can be translated to a bad climber, but there's no specific, I'm using air quotes, climbing skill. You might watch the Tour de France and they're like, oh, he's a climber. It's simpler than that. It's just your power output and the force of gravity, rolling resistance, and air resistance. Those are the only factors in there, as long as you have appropriate gearing.
Yeah, so in your case...
kind of a different way to think about it.
In your case, Ted, with the strength-to-weight ratio that Nate's talking about, it sounds like you already have the weight thing under control if you say you're the right size for hill climbing. So really growing your FTP is about the best thing you can do.
Bodo, I've been using Trainer Road for close to a year and have gone through base, build, and specialty training blocks. That's good to hear. Good to hear, Bodo. Hopefully it made you faster. I'm sure it did. And for those that don't know, we break up our training into three different phases, our training plans, I should say, so that it's easy for you to plan your training throughout the year so that you can revert after an A event and you can go back and you can go back into a build phase, base phase, whatever else you need. It makes it simple, just like building blocks. I recently had a reduced cycling schedule and would like to start back doing another build block. I have a short-term goal of doing some road biking in Maui after Christmas and New Year. That sounds like a good thing to do. and am focusing on riding the West Maui Loop on multiple days. It's a 100-kilometer ride around the west half of Maui with some significant climbs on the first half of the ride. I'm not racing in Maui, but want to feel fit and strong on the rides and be able to do the ride on multiple days during my two-week visit. I'm thinking the low-volume, sustained power build would be the best plan to embark on over the next 8 weeks to prepare. Is this the best use of my time over the next 8 weeks?
Yeah, Bodo, I think that's a really good way to go, considering you've already got what sounds like base fitness or, you know, close enough equivalent. So the sustained power build has a nice blend of high-end aerobic stuff, you know, VO2 max stuff, and then muscular endurance stuff, both of which you're going to rely on with a ride, based on what I understand with your description. Yeah, for 8 weeks, I think you could do much worse. I honestly can't think of a better approach. That sounds pretty good.
Another thing, just a comment, a couple comments on that. When we say low volume, sustained power, that means that we're prescribing three workouts a week. They range anywhere from 60 minutes to about 120 minutes on the weekend. And like Chad said, they're mostly threshold and some VO2 max. Also, with depending on how you want to ride the course, if you want to ride it really even, that's probably the best one. You could also go down to what we call the general build, which is general build for volume, for low volume. It's four rides a week, and you get a little bit more of the punchy stuff. So if you like to kind of, you know, kind of ride lower and then hit the hills really hard, that might be a better plan. And in general, too, it's a little bit more varied, I think. What do you think, Chad, than sustained?
Yeah. Like, no, it is. It is. It is. I mean, it kind of mixes the best of the short power and the sustained power. So it is more varied. And in a situation like his, it's perfectly applicable.
Yeah. So either one of those is good. Kind of whatever floats your boat in types of the enjoyment you'll get. What kind of intervals? Do you like longer intervals or kind of a short, varied, shorter, harder, and more intense intervals?
Yeah. And that brings up a good point, too. I mean, in situations like these where you don't have a competitive event that you're trying to build optimal fitness toward, enjoy yourself. I mean, always try to enjoy yourself along the way, but in a situation like this, especially so. Try to enjoy the training as much as, you know, the actual vacation you're heading toward.
Yeah, work on getting a tan too, Bodo. You'll be in Maui, so make sure your tan lines are strong. David, there are six sweet spot base options out of your sweet spot base training plans. How do you choose one? So he's just asking Chad about which of all the different training plans. There's a slight misunderstanding about six of them total.
Yeah.
Some of those are cumulative. Can you explain that?
Yeah, so we use a chronological naming convention. So one precedes two, two precedes three. And this goes for both the sweet spot base and the traditional base and any training plans that have a one and two version. One comes first. So do the first one, then move on to the second one. And then it's just a matter of volume options, low, mid, or high. So and this is a question we're going to address in greater detail later as well, as far as which of those volumes do you choose. But that's what it boils down to, David.
And for those who aren't familiar with our plans, that means, you know, if you do both of them back to back, that's about 12 weeks of sweet spot base. And the reason why we have them in blocks like that is because not everyone has 12 weeks. Like, some people might start later, as you'll hear on this podcast. So having 6 weeks is better than 12 weeks or than no weeks. So that's why we do kind of smaller blocks for the base phase.
Graham. I'm a keen cyclist from the UK and do many different disciplines, including road sportives and mountain biking. I've been with Trainer Road for the last 2 years and have enjoyed it very much, but not completed a full training plan of base, build, and specialty up until now. But we're glad to have you just the same, Graham. I've identified a number of different 100K and 150K sportive road mountain bike races, which I want to compete in next year. The A cross-country mountain bike race, which I want to do well in, is in August of 2016. I've started traditional base low volume one and have planned to do 7 weeks of low. And this is, by the way, these are all our training plans once again. So, and we'll break this down a little later. But I've planned on doing 7 weeks of low volume one, 5 weeks of low volume two, and 5 weeks of low volume three. So he's going to split up the three parts that we have traditional base in. He's going to modify the length slightly. To improve my base and increase my power to weight ratio by reducing my weight, I've looked into an 8-week build, maybe general build, and 8-week specialty build, but I am unsure which would be the best for me. Also, I've recently purchased the Stages power meter and have done my first FTP test, a 20-minute FTP test of the power meter. My FTP has gone from 210 with virtual power to 242 with the power meter. It's important to know that you probably just rely on your power meter for that stuff, since virtual power is a different measurement of power in that case. I'm just concerned it's very different, as my fitness has not improved enough to cause this change. So really, I guess that effectively answers the last part.
Yeah, we got two questions there.
Let me address the virtual power one real fast.
Yes.
If people who aren't familiar with that, virtual power is TrainerRoad's way to turn your trainer into a power meter with just a speed sensor. And what we do is every trainer has a specific power curve. So, for instance, the Kirk Kinetic Road Machine, it's as you go faster, it uses fluid and it gets harder to pedal. What we've done is we've measured that power curve so that we can say if you're going 22 miles per hour, you're putting out, say, 220 watts. The thing to know about virtual power is that it's the thing that we don't measure is the rolling resistance, and there could be some slight manufacturing differences between trainers. And so what you can't do with virtual power is compare it to a power meter or anything else. But what you do have to do is keep your setup consistent. So if you pump your tire up the same, use the same tire, use the same trainer, you should be able to work out to work out, get the same you can work out like you have a power meter. It's kind of like going to the gym. And imagine if all the weights in the gym were off by, let's say, 25 pounds. But you could still make progression. So, you know, you're doing bench press at 100 pounds, and then you're doing at 110 and 120. Well, maybe that's actually 150, 160, 170. As long as it's consistent, it's good. So what you can't do then is get a, you know, virtual power, then you go buy a Stages power meter and go, oh, it's, you know, my FTP's changed by 30 watts just because I've put a power meter on my bike. No, now you've got as long as your power meter is a reliable power meter, you have a true way to measure and compare between other people. And if you have a power meter, we suggest you only use that and just use that number from now on.
Perfect. And as far as going into the first part of his question, Chad, let's address that a little bit as far as he's preparing for a cross-country mountain bike race. And correct us if we're wrong here, Graham, but I assume that it's going to be a longer event. So you would be looking at preparing for a longer event. Chad, what would you say there?
Yeah, you're much like all the guys we've talked about so far, all the riders we've talked about so far, and that you've got a lot of time to work with. So the traditional base is a good approach. The fact that you're up in the weeks, down in the weeks, you've got in total, looks like 12, 17 weeks of base. Great. And then you're looking to work your build program general. I would recommend veering more sustained, because this sort of effort, even though it is a mountain bike race, you're going to spend a lot of time working in tempo and sweet spot. So, you know, 70, 80, 85% of your threshold. So do the sustained route. And then when it comes time to pick a specialty, this again would probably be a good fit for marathon mountain bike. You could also use the Century Plan, but it is a mountain bike race and there are going to be some punchy demands. So the marathon specialty plan is probably your best.
Perfect. Let's move on here and let's get to Ben's question. Ben, this is, wrong question there. We're going to go to Kevin's question. Kevin asks, I've been using TrainerRoad for about a year, and it's been enormously helpful. The training plans, coaching tips embedded in the workouts, tech support on the few occasions that you've needed them, and blog have been first rate. That's awesome. That's good. We're firing on all cylinders. So good, in fact, I had to reach out to come up with a question, but here it is. I'm doing the deep breathing during VO2 max intervals that are suggested during the workouts, forcefully exhaling. I often end up with numbness in my teeth and gums by the end of the workout. Is this totally weird? Any suggestions on how to avoid it? Chad, what do you say?
If I'm honest,
this is totally weird.
Yeah, I have nothing for you on this. I don't know if you're training in a cold room and the fact that you're inhaling, exhaling so powerfully is actually chilling your teeth and gums, but there's nothing in terms of training that I can even tie to this.
Yeah, I don't know either. What can happen and this has happened, Chad's doing Chad's workouts, is in VO2 max, you can taste copper in your mouth,
mm-hmm.
and that will definitely happen. And you're going anaerobic when that happens. But yeah, numb teeth. I don't know what numb teeth is, but yeah, I've maybe go see a doctor because that doesn't.
That's unusual.
That's weird.
Yeah, I was just going to suggest the same thing. Yeah, exactly. A doctor, I think, would be the best one to talk to on that for sure. Naren, I have an FTP of around 250. However, when using Trainer Road, I'm unable to get my heart rate above 130 BPM. I feel as though I am working reasonably hard and have an average cadence of 90 to 100. Should I increase my cadence, or do you think I was a bit lazy when I did the FTP test?
Yeah, Naren, I think you nailed it. I don't know that you were lazy necessarily, but FTP testing is an acquired skill. You get better every time you do it. It's really hard to face a new rider or even one who's not experienced training with power with a couple 8-minute time trials or a 20-minute time trial and expect them to pace that in such a way that it's representative of what they can do if they have their best ever effort. So you probably didn't test to your full capabilities, in which case you can on the fly modify the workouts, bring the workout intensity up as you realize the intervals just aren't challenging, your heart rate, your perceived exertion, you're just not working hard enough, it's not there. You can also go in to your profile and change your threshold. But the fact of the matter is you're probably under-challenging yourself right now. And in the case of VO2 max work, those should be hard. Those should be hard every time. And the closing third of each of those intervals should require great focus. I mean, they're tough. And if that's not the case, then you probably undershot your FTP test a bit.
I have a comment in general about heart rate, because a lot of people, they'll want to compare heart rate from person to person. And that's one reason why we don't use heart rate. There's a whole bunch of things that can affect heart rate day to day. But in general, your heart rate, the amount of blood you push is a factor of both your beats per minute and your stroke volume, how strong it is. So you see a lot of people that have a generally lower heart rate, and they're just pumping more blood per every beat. So just because you have a low heart rate doesn't mean that there's something wrong with you. And also, like, I have an extremely high heart rate. I'm a big guy too. I'm 6'6". And in a bike race, I've gotten my heart rate up to 202 BPMs. Some people, you might, you know, if you think you were lazy, you probably were. Like, you know if you're not lazy, right? Like if you get out the FTP test, and there shouldn't be any question if you tested as hard as you could or not. But in general, don't think that just because you have a low heart rate that there's something wrong with you. You're just a diesel engine.
Yeah, exactly. So Nate, when you put out 202 BPM, what sort of watts were you pushing?
Oh, I was it was the end of a crit, and I think I did like a 2-minute flyer. So I want to say I was over 500 for 2 minutes, maybe like right around 500 for 2 minutes. And at the end, it was just I won the race.
And as an FYI, I'm younger than Nate, and I have never seen 202 beats per minute.
Yeah,
so that gives you just the idea of the relativity of heart rate.
And that's the point I'm trying to make. So I can put out 350, 360 watts for extended periods of time. My heart rate won't crack 160. So it's very subjective.
Yeah, Chad and Jonathan are both stronger than me, and my heart rate's way higher than them. But that doesn't mean, and that also, it's another little tangent, but a side point. Just because I have a higher heart rate doesn't mean I put out more calories. Jonathan and Chad actually burn more calories than I do because they have more, they output more power. And that's the calories are based on how much work your body does, not how fast your heart rate is. And I know a lot of fitness equipment at the gym and other systems will just use your heart rate, and it's a guesstimation. And this is a perfect example of Chad can ride forever at 360 watts at 150 beats per M. I can ride 360 watts for not very long, and my heart rate will be really high. But or let's say I can, at the same heart rate, I'll be putting out 210 watts, but he's burning more calories because he's actually doing more work.
Yeah, exactly. Power is a fantastic tool for measuring that. Just another reason why power is definitely something that you should keep track of. Having said that, with your heart rate, the best way to use that, we've covered this on our blog. We have a 3 Ways to Train blog, and we actually just shared this out recently, but we really break down how to effectively use heart rate or how to most effectively use heart rate, and that touches on resting heart rate and using that to measure. It's all relative to you.
Yeah.
With enough time and enough data, you'll be able to recognize changes in your heart rate and perhaps tie those to different influences in your life, whether that be anything from diet to stress to activity. And that's when it becomes really valuable. Having said that, it's also something that, once again, is still variable. It's a highly variable metric. So power is king for this in many ways. Paul, we already answered your question indirectly, but I believe we gave you some sound advice on how to become a faster climber. So we'll move on here to Stuart's question.
And just a quick hello to Paul. He's a local rider, and he used to do my bike classes. So, hey, Paul.
Oh, sweet. Awesome. Very cool. Good to have you on here, Paul. Stuart, I found that when I go from an upright riding position in the aero position and keeping my cadence and gears exactly the same, my power reading goes down by 5 to 10 watts. We actually have just heard about this recently. Initially, I took this as a bad thing, but when I was thinking about it some more, and you're wondering if this means I am being more efficient in an aero position. If my cadence and gears haven't changed, then my speed would be unaltered at a lower power output, is my thinking. Mm-hmm. Do you have any comment on this? I actually prefer to ride in the aero position than on the bullhorns, if this is relevant.
Stuart, I think, unfortunately, you've actually got it backwards. If you're changing your position and you're suffering a power drop, nothing else is changing, then you're actually sacrificing efficiency. So, in your case, you're either going to have to figure out, do those increased aerodynamics outweigh the loss of 5 to 10 watts, or perhaps you need to spend more time training. Sounds like you do a lot of time training in the aero position, so that's probably not it. But in any case, maybe a bike fit manipulation of some sort, but the fact that you're losing power when you change positions is undesirable.
Well, and two, I think just about, Chad, correct me if I'm wrong, but everyone can put out less power in an aero position, especially on a TT bike, than on a road bike.
Yeah, almost across the board.
It has to do with your hip angle. But you're going to, especially if you only lose 5 to 10 watts, you're going to put out more, you're going to go faster in the aero position because of wind resistance. The only time you'd wouldn't want to do that is if you're climbing a hill. And I've talked with Ryan from Best Bike Split, who he does this crazy aerodynamic profiling with pros, and he can predict like a pro's time trial time, even with wind and hills and all that. And he says what the best pros do is they switch to get out of aero once they hit about 14 miles per hour on a climb.
Exactly.
So that's what I've been following with him, is I will, be as aero as I can. And then once I hit 14, I kind of sit up more and gain that power. And one last thing about this is, I know you think that it's the same cadence and therefore the same gear and you're going the same. 5 to 10 watts is really not that much and really hard to feel. And even though your cadence looks like it's like right around, let's say 90, there, I would trust your power meter, and there is a slight difference in that. And that's, even though it's not perceivable by you, it would be perceivable with your overall power output and speed. But again, you're probably going faster in the aero, and I would just keep doing that.
Yeah, in your case, that's such a small difference that there's a good chance, a real good chance, that you're making up for it in terms of aerodynamics.
Kieran, you ask, on the 8-minute test, that FTP test, that's one of our tests that we have, one of the workouts that we have to assess what your FTP is. You ask, are both 8-minute VO2 blocks used to calculate FTP?
Yes.
Yeah, they are.
They are in our system.
They're not full on VO2 blocks. They're a little lower than that, but that is how we work it. The only exception is if there's a vast disparity. I'm pretty sure there's some logic in there that, you do your first 8-minute effort at say 250, and then your second one at 150. We're not gonna. I actually don't know if we average.
It's not that logic's not in there, but that should be added. So here's one thing for everyone to know: if you're doing the 2x8-minute kind of test for your FTP in train to road or not. If you do, if you pace them both well and they're close, we'll take the average. But if you, like Chad said, you just give up on one, just take the average of the other one. And then as you go into more workouts and more interval training, you can tweak your FTP. So if, and this is okay for anyone, if you feel like you're doing VO2 max workouts and they're easy, up your FTP by 5 watts. Mm-hmm. If you can't complete a workout, all of our workouts are designed to be completable. If you can't complete it, definitely lower your look at your overall recovery and stress and stuff, but you probably want to lower your FTP by five watts at a time until you can complete the workouts.
You might miss a workout here and there, but if you have a string of workouts that aren't going as planned, then something's wrong.
Yeah, that's a good point. So just after one workout, you have a bad night's sleep or a stressful work day, don't just immediately do it.
Kieran, you have another question. You mentioned that you have a power meter and you're currently following the sweet spot base 1 mid-volume plan. Once again, we've already described what that plan is. And my power tap is currently setting up on the trainer, and I've been swapping out one of the longer weekend trainer rides for a club ride of 3 to 6 hours. I want to know, should I continue to use my power meter on the club rides, which are generally fairly steady? Chad, go ahead with this one.
I'm unclear. Do you mean, do you want to record the data, or do you want the power output to restrict what you're doing? I'm going to assume that you're saying you don't want what we're trying to accomplish with the workout to restrict your outdoor riding.
I'm guessing if he's in a club ride, he's just riding for 3 to 6 hours because, you know, we're not going to give a 6 hour one. I would use your power meter and collect that data because, you know, it can give you a good measurement of your stress. So if you uploaded that something like Training Peaks, you can get your TSS score, and that might help you. Like if, you know, we prescribe, let's say 140 TSS over the weekend, but you're consistently doing these 300 TSS rides and you start to get tired, well, then you can look at that and say, well, I'm actually doubling what's prescribed by Trainer Road on the weekend. So therefore that could be the reason. That probably is the reason why I'm now getting tired and maybe getting a little burnt out.
Yeah. So if Kieran, if that's what you're asking, then data collection is never a bad thing. You may never use it, but the fact that you have it and can use it is absolutely something you want.
Steven, it's your second year riding with the cycling plan, third year overall. I ride with the Power 2 Max power meter and have a heart rate strap. During base phase, particularly base 1, should I be more focused on my power zone or heart rate zone? For example, if a plan calls for a lot of zone 1 and zone 2, and I proceed to ride at zone 1 or zone 2 power, my heart rate will be at zone 2 or zone 3. I attribute my higher heart rate zone mostly due to inexperience at cycling and a litany of transplant drugs that you take. But as of now, during base phases, I try to keep my heart rate to zone 1 or zone 2 and disregard my power levels. Is this wise? And you mentioned, or you asked, or should I just focus on riding zone 1, zone 2 power, and eventually my heart rate will align once I become more experienced? This ties in line with what we've just been saying with the heart rate stuff again.
Yeah, so Steven, with traditional base and the long, slow approach, we're looking for changes in your heart rate to power ratio or your heart rate to any other metric ratio. So we're trying to improve, once again, your ability to metabolize fat, and that's done best, especially in the long term, at a lower heart rate. You're kind of a special case. If I'm reading this correctly, bilateral lung transplant, that takes you out of the realm of most of the riders we deal with, in which case this is probably a better question for your physician than for us. But in your case, I'd pay more attention to heart rate than power.
What about, so this is actually, Chad and I talk about this a lot, and there's something called, Joe Friel came with this concept called heart rate decoupling, and I don't know if there's any studies behind it, but he talks about doing, well, I've never seen a study behind it, but about doing a constant power output, and then once your heart rate stops raising on that, that means your base training is done.
Yeah, I
see the other side of that is it's really, your FTP is now increased, therefore you're not really training anymore, and your heart rate doesn't go up anymore. There's like the other side of that, right? Of your power and your FTP. So in general, what we recommend through traditional base is we're all watching your, if you have a valid FTP test, you're really doing the riding based on your power, and it might lower your heart rate, but some people, it don't feel like if your heart rate's never lowered that whole time, that you somehow missed out on base training. It really trusts the power zones.
Yeah, that's a good point. Power is just a superior metric. I mean, it's objective. It's not as flimsy or affected by so many variables as heart rate. So trying to define a distinct and clear correlation between heart rate and power, it's a fool's errand. It's going to change at times, and that can be misleading.
Jacob, I'm a 38-year-old amateur road, cross, and mountain bike racer who has been racing consistently for about 9 years and doing 15 to 20 races a year. I have okay levels of short-duration power, but my FTP sustained power has always been a big weakness and limiter for me. I've seen lots of people new to racing, training, and trainer road experience rapid, significant gains in FTP. We'll take the credit for that one, which I'll call more than 10%. So an example of this is like 30 to 40 watts for a guy with a 250-watt FTP. As they go through their first experience with focused, structured training plans, this is their experience. I haven't seen this to anybody who, like me, has been racing and training for a number of years. So my question, is this effect, the significant gains in FTP for an experienced older athlete who is not new to training, even possible? Chad, what do you say to that one?
Yeah, it might not be. It depends on what your level of fitness is and how close to your potential you've pushed it. So you may be at a point where you're close to max out, and increases of 10%, those are massive in trained athletes. I mean, you got Olympic athletes who will work literally 4 years for a 1% or a 0.5% gain. So as you push yourself closer and closer to your genetic and physiological, psychological capabilities or potentials, those gains are going to get incrementally smaller, and you're going to have to make yourself happy with those, because you're just not going to see 10% bumps on an annual basis if you're very fit and you know, working at a high level of what your body is ultimately capable of.
And having
go ahead.
Having said that, I don't want to make any type of a conclusion about your fitness, Jacob, but just in general, I've always found that when people do pick up structured training in an environment that allows like indoor training that's extremely focused, even very trained athletes find a massive benefit from that. So you will see an increase, but as far as how big of an increase that is, like Chad said, that's all relative to your percentage of fulfillment of your potential, right?
So stop looking at that.
Can be help everybody.
Stop looking at that 10% and consider, you know, what's going to give you 2 or 3%, or, you know, something that's a little better than last year. And as you age, that's kind of a tough battle to counter. But it might be that you have a significant relative to you, your significant muscle endurance, and you need to focus on your VO2 max for a while. That whole roof ceiling thing, where your VO2 max is the roof, and you can push your ceiling, your functional threshold up toward that roof. Past the point, you can't push it up any higher. Now you got to lift the roof again. So you got to focus on VO2 max work to lift your aerobic capacity a little more, so that you can push your functional threshold up a little more. But even then, the gains are going to be incremental. You're probably not going to see 10%. So stop chasing that 10% and just look for, you know, improvement relative to you alone.
Another thing Jacob says is that he's okay on the short durations power, but his FTP and sustained power has been a big weakness. And I've experienced the same thing. As if you look at my power profiling, I do extremely well in short duration power, VO2 max, and I'm just more of I have a higher anaerobic work capacity. And FTP and sustained power is something that I need to work on. So Chad, he could also just try to specialize in the short power duration in his racing.
Yeah.
But what do you think he should do over the winter? I'm looking at the rest of his question. Let's say we do want him to get his FTP up. And Jacob, you know, I really think we can get your FTP up with the right plan. What do you think, what kind of training he should do during the winter?
Well, he might be one of those guys whose fitness is so topped out that a long, slow approach is merited and might be necessary. So if you've got the time to devote to something like traditional base, that, you know, that's one route to go. If you don't, you can still see improvements with sweet spot base and focusing most of your time on improved muscular endurance, which sounds like is an issue for you. So I think you can't really lose in either of those cases. And then you're looking to grow your sustainable power, your muscular endurance. So that is going to require some work in that realm, sustained power and sweet spot and threshold sort of efforts.
And something to keep in mind, Jacob, you're doing a lot of racing. You're doing road, cross, mountain bike. That's a year-round approach that you're taking to racing. And many times, if you don't periodize your training effectively, you can be running at, you know, 70% of your potential, let's say, or 80%, just to attach a high percentage to whatever your potential is, but never being able to truly reach your peak because you haven't allowed your body to recover enough to increase your freshness to the point where you can actually get some momentum going again. That can kind of happen, right, Chad? I mean, if you're doing every type of racing year around, you can find yourself running flat and hunting for gains that just are not possible to get.
That's a really astute observation. I'm sorry we missed that. You may be just tired, and that puts a real general term on it. But if you're gravitating from one discipline to the next, and never really seeing a down season, you're going to get to a certain level and you're not ever going to push above that level. You're just going to keep on grinding yourself down, and it might be small changes annually, but you're never going to see that big bump. You're never going to see 10%. You might not see 5. So you have to decide at some point in the year what's important to you and what's not, and what isn't. Find a way to weave in a bit of recovery.
Yeah, pick your battles, and that'll really help you actually maintain or reach the point that you want to, for sure. Alan, I find my heart rate rises when I drop down into the arrow position on the tri bars. I am thinking it's because of reduced lung capacity, or do you have another explanation?
Well, if you are reducing your lung capacity, and your heart rate's probably going to fall right along with it. So that, I don't think that's it. I think the fact is you're putting greater stress on your body because you're pushing yourself into an unfamiliar position and one that's not powerful. So if the output, the output drops, or let's say the output stays the same, but your heart rate rises, that means the work rate, you know, what you're putting out is the same, yet your body's working harder for it. So it could be a measure of maybe flexibility. It could be it's position related. I can almost promise you whether or not you can correct it by adapting to that position, or if you need to adapt the position is the next question.
Yeah, I think normally with the TT stuff, it's all about hip angle, because your hip angle is going to be changing. Mm-hmm. And I'm guessing it's probably hurting his efficiency as he's going, and that's raising his heart rate at the same power.
Exactly. So somewhere in there, you're kind of working against yourself. You went from a position that worked for you and put out the power that your body can do into a position that doesn't work for you, and it's restricting that power.
Mads, my goal for next season is an FTP of 370 watts measured with a kicker, probably 350-ish with the vector stages. I use Training Peaks to monitor my training plan. Yeah, that's an interesting point there. So I use Training Peaks to monitor my training, and I follow my CTL, ATL, and TSB on a daily basis, which, Chad, hopefully you can help us out with all these acronyms here.
Sure.
We have a lot of alphabet soup in this one. Today, my FTP is 305 watts. I know my goal is a bit hairy, but I have been there before. I truly believe I can reach those heights again and be consistent there when on form. I use Trainer Road and the kicker for all my quality sessions you do. My CTL today is 54. What would you reckon my CTL should be when I reach my goal? So, Chad, can we define CTL,
sure,
ATL, and TSB?
Yeah, this is a pretty techie question with a lot of techie terms, but CTL is your chronic training load. That's your fitness. ATL is acute training load. That's your fatigue. And stress balance is how those two relate to one another. Ideally, you have a positive TSB, your stress balance, come race day, when you're beating yourself up with big load cycles, it's going to be low. In your case, your chronic load or your fitness, you know, what's more sustained is 54, and you're looking at big numbers. Unless you're like 400 pounds of muscle, those are big numbers. And it's hard to quantify this. I mean, different bodies respond differently. You could nudge that up to 80 and reach that 350-370 watt threshold. You may need to push that up to 100-110. I can only guess, knowing the little bit that I know.
Yeah, I think it's not like there is a magic CTL number to reach your goal. It's what's the maximum stress my body can take and recover from.
Exactly.
So some pro riders, they respond really well on not a lot of CTL, and let's just call it TSS, because that's what CTL is. So average and TSS is training stress score, so how much stress I have. Some pros need a ton of stress, and the same goes for people that are lower. Some people get a really good response on just 3 workouts a week. Some people need more. So really try to, and this is something personal you have to do, you have to figure out how much training stress your body can take. Like, for example, we have low, medium, and high training plans where there's more rides and more stress on the high volume training plans. You could be a beginner and take a high training plan, or you could be very experienced and only be able to handle the low volume. It depends on your sleep quality, your nutrition, your how well your body can recover from stuff, your stress at work, your stress at home, It's a whole huge combination of things. So don't just chase like, oh, I need to, you know, I need to do 800 TSS a week because that's what my buddy who does, who's a Cat 1 writer. And if I don't do 800 TSS a week, I'll never reach my goals.
Yeah, it all has to be, you can take. It all has to be relative to you. So, I mean, you can have writer A, writer B. One does 80 TSS average per week. The other does 120 and they get the same results. This is real. This happens.
Absolutely. These metrics that you use, sometimes it's pretty easy to get lost in the metrics themselves and lose view of context. And Chad's always very, he says that the data that we collect when we're riding and everything else, this should always just inform our perception. We should use it as an informative thing. And that I think this is another example of where that's applicable. Not just if your power meter goes out, what wattage do I ride at now since I don't have a power meter, because that's the common context in which that's brought up. But also, when you're measuring and figuring these things out, if you have a good enough fix on how your body reacts to certain levels of training stress, then you'll be able to manage, or I should say predict, where your CTL should be when you reach your goal pretty effectively. I don't know if there's anything else to add on there. So
yeah. So whether you guys recognize it or not, you've invested yourself in a perpetual learning process. You're never going to have this figured out, but you're always going to know more.
Perfect. Yeah. It'd be great too, if you could say, hey, you know what? I can handle, let's say 300 TSS a week. And then you go up to, 350 for a while, see how that feels. Maybe something changes in your life. Like, you kind of use yourself as an experiment. And if, you know, you maybe do one of our challenges and you get 800 TSS in 1 week. And then, you know, in the next week, you're back down to 200. A little super compensation once in a while like that. And you might say, hey, that really does make my body respond well. Is doing a training camp is another place where you can get a lot of TSS in a week and kind of experiment with how you recover and how you might improve by little short bouts of super compensation like that.
Yeah, I'd go as far as saying that's almost that should be something that is encouraged for you to dose and then measure the response on your end. So
yeah,
you'll never really understand your boundaries until you exploit them. I mean, sometimes you gotta push to that point where it's too much.
Yeah, great point. Mike asks, is it okay to ride a TT or a tri bike for all trainer road rides? Or do we need to have a road bike for optimal results? You mentioned that you currently have a TT bike only for training, not a true road bike. So, Chad, what do you say? Mike, do a little bit of both, and you have a lot of bikes that you train on indoors.
I do. So, and it boils down to, you know, what my events are. So in your case, Mike, if your events are on a TT bike and that's the only bike you have, you're good to go. It's once again, a question of specificity. So, absolutely train on the bike that you plan to race on.
Yeah. And another point to this is if you're a triathlete and sometimes people have, you know, bad fits or bad saddles and it will hurt to be on your TT bike. But if you're a triathlete and that's your goal is to do triathlons as fast as you can, do all your rides on your TT bike. Cause you know, there's so much position adaption and you adapt to putting power out in that position. There's no reason why you should only do a road bike. And also, if you're a mountain biker, you know, that's going to be a much wider open hip angle. And if you can get a kicker or put a slick tire on your mountain bike, like it's you can lock out your suspension. It's not a bad idea to practice or train on the bike you're going to race on.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, Mike, actually, you use the term optimal, which makes me believe that you're event focused, or you want the best results possible. So you're not looking for necessarily the highest power numbers. You're looking for the best results, and the best results are going to come by training in the way that you're going to race on the bike that you're going to use.
Yeah, Mike, I really do notice, and I think it's more a muscular endurance thing. My functional threshold power has not changed, but my ability to maintain that power and the position that's unique to the bike definitely does change. And I'm primarily a mountain biker, but I do a lot of road racing as well. And I used my mountain bike this year a lot on the trainer, and I had my best year on the mountain bike yet. It's a similar situation, perhaps just not quite as pronounced as what you might experience from a road to a TT bike. So
yeah, performance is position specific, speed specific. I mean, again, as specific as you can make it to the way you want to perform during the events that are most important to you becomes increasingly crucial as you push your training toward those events.
Yeah, you just brought up a good point too, Chad, and one other part that I think could be good. If you have a road bike and you have a compact and you're always spinning at a certain thing and or whatever gearing you have, I would try to emulate the gearing that you're going to have if you have an electronic trainer, that is. I would try to emulate the gearing that you have or will be using on race day. So, for example, if I do all my training on my road bike and I've got a compact crankset on my road bike, but then on the mountain bike, I've got a 32-tooth chainring, a super tiny little guy up front, and then an 11-speed cassette on the back that allows me to crawl along at 4 miles an hour, and most of my race is going to require me to ride at 4 miles an hour. If you're using an electronic trainer, ride in the gearing that you will use on race day. I noticed a huge difference with this because of the fact that you've got a big flywheel. There's a difference in the feel and the momentum that you have when you're carrying on, you know, maxed out in your 50 up front and then down into your 11 versus being all the way down into your smallest smallest gearing combination. It really does make a difference.
Yeah, and in that same vein.
This has to do.
Sorry, go ahead, Nate.
Oh. This has to do with, as Jonathan said, the inertia that's on your trainer. And this is a good a few examples. Some people come from outside and they go inside and they find out they can't put enough power out. This is why Kirk Kinetic has that big flywheel that you can put on the back of it, is that and I'm like this too. I'm a high inertia rider, so I mash a lot. Well, not mash, but I'm pretty quad dominant when I ride. And when having so the kicker, if you put it in its highest gear, the rear, the flywheel was going to spin really fast, and you're going to have kind of like a more road-like experience, unless you're doing something like mountain biking or cyclocross where you're going really slow, and that means that you're not going to have a lot of inertia in your rear wheel, and you're going to be pushing through more of the pedal stroke. So as Jonathan said, you want to simulate that, and you can only really simulate it with electronic trainer. You can't simulate it with a like a kicker. You can simulate with a kicker or copy trainer. You can't do it with a like a fluid trainer or a mag trainer or something like that, because they're just maybe a mag trainer, but a fluid trainer, there just won't be enough resistance at those low speeds.
Yeah, that you bring up a good point, Nate. If there is a virtue, because mag trainers definitely are not in vogue, right? We are having so many new trainers that are coming out, but if there is a virtue to a mag trainer, it's that you can actually put out high levels of power at low speeds pretty effectively. And that is one great thing. So, yeah, take it from me. I showed up at a national championship having done everything in my 50-11, and then I had to climb for 20 miles, and that was terrible. I sucked. So don't do that. Adam, I've noticed that I tend to get injured right after the Sufferfest and 8DC. And for those that don't know, he's really talking about the tour of Sufferlandria and then 8DC. So we have indoor cycling challenges like 8DC. And what those are is essentially we have 8 workouts prescribed in 8 days for 8DC. And you walk through just like we even have a storyline on the workout text in front of you, and you walk through like you're doing an event. And it's a hard training block. It's not designed to be impossible. 8DC isn't, but it's very much designed to push you to your limits. So there's 7 or 8 days of workouts without recovery in between those days. How do I better prepare for these kind of efforts? And the context is, I assume, to avoid this injury that you're talking about. Chad, what do you say?
Adam, this is a super good question, and I have so much to say on this matter that I'm going to have to decide which is what's most important to me. I literally stress when I develop these workouts, knowing that people are going to try to do all 7 or 8 of these workouts, one right after the other. It's too much work for most people to do at 100% workout intensity, which is why, one of the many reasons why we have an adjuster that you can tweak on the fly. If your body's not accustomed to working hard multiple days in a row, and you know 3 or 4 is one thing, but 7 or 8 is entirely another, you have to tweak that intensity a bit. My recommendation is with something like this, treat it like a regular training week, just one that's interspersed with more active recoveries or downright stressful recoveries perhaps. So if you do intervals on Tuesdays and Thursdays, leave it at 100% on Tuesdays and Thursdays. But if you recover on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, maybe turn it down to 90, 80, even 70% on those days where you recognize you're tired. I mean, you're not a grand tour rider. You don't have to train like one. And yeah, it's going to result in injury in some cases. So be sensible and decide which days you feel good and really get after it. On days you don't feel good, drop that workout intensity, still get the workout in, still get your medal, your completion badge, and just like I said, be sensible about it.
It's to people who are not familiar with this, that's you get about 800 TSS over a week.
It's huge.
Which is, that's huge. I think I have a, to get put in perspective, I have a Cat 1 Pro, and he aims for that like 1 month of the year. He, a Cat 1 friend, and he does about that for 1 month, and that's all he can sustain. And he's like, you know, this is amazing, amazing cyclist. You can't think of like, hey, you know, I took November, December off, and I rode for a week, and then I'm going to jump into eight extremely hard workouts right in a row. Like Chad said, you could turn it down. The best way to prepare for this, imagine if, you know, this is 800 TSS week. If you were doing 500 TSS weeks for many weeks before that, then it wouldn't be that big of a jump. But if you're doing 100 or no TSS, then it's a giant jump. And like Chad said, a lot of people just, we're all not Cat 1 riders for a reason. A lot of people just can't take that amount of stress. Mm-hmm. And do it. So if you, you know, we make it hard on purpose, but it's totally fine to turn it down. Don't think that, you know, I've turned down stages of it too. You try not to, but you do. And two, afterwards, don't jump right back in training, right? Like the next week, oh, I'm going to do Sunday's the last day. And then on Tuesday, I'm going to do this really hard workout. Know that you did this extremely hard thing. And take a recovery week. Do just some active recovery spinning for that next week.
Yeah, you're not coming off of an Ironman triathlon exactly, but the stress is probably, for most people, well outside of what they're used to. So absolutely take your recovery seriously for the, you know, half week following that.
And one thing that we haven't directly addressed here with Adam, too, is, Adam, chances are the efforts themselves, because you say, how do I better prepare for these kinds of efforts? The efforts themselves are not causing the injury. Perhaps there's an underlying issue that you may have with alignment or any type of imbalance that you might have. Mm-hmm. You know, like, especially if you see, look at this like a training camp. If you have a training camp coming up, you know that you're going to have to be on the bike for a long time. You're going to want to make sure that you have your tubes. You're going to want to make sure that your bike is in working condition. You're going to want to make sure you have patches, everything that you would need, right? And think about your body in the same perspective. You're going to want to make sure that you don't have any type of alignment issues with your knees, with tightness in your hips that might cause any type of injury if you really are going to put in a lot of stress. So there's a number of ways of taking care of that, everything from bike fits to seeing a physical therapist to any number of things. But I would try to get that squared away prior to jumping into anything that's going to put you through so much stress. So it looks like we're out of time today, so we're going to cut that off there. There's a lot of questions we haven't gone to, but do know that we will get those questions answered to you throughout the week as we come up here, and submit your questions for the next one. We will be having another Ask a Cycling Coach podcast next week. Just doing our best to make you guys faster. That's the goal. So you can listen to us on SoundCloud. You can find us also on iTunes. You can log on there, give us a review on iTunes. Let us know if you're appreciating the podcast and what you love about it. And you can submit your questions to us at support@trainerroad.com. And we'll answer them as we go throughout the week and in this podcast. We appreciate it, guys. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks, everybody.
Thank you.